12. And as we always do, Acts chapter 1 is about Ascension Apostle. Acts chapter 2 is about Spirit Kingdom. All right, everyone say on three together. Acts chapter 2 is about Spirit Kingdom. I know you guys can do this. You've been doing it for half a year. Acts chapter 3 is about Second Sermon. Acts chapter 4 is about Peter's defense. And after that, Peter gets loose, John gets loose, and then Acts chapter 5 is about first discipline, second defense. That's when all the apostles are arrested after Ananias and Sapphira were struck dead by the Holy Spirit. Acts chapter 6 is the tricky one, is about the seven. Acts chapter 7 is about Stephen's death or Stephen's defense. Acts chapter 8, there's the sorcerer, his name is Simon, and then there's an Ethiopian eunuch. That's right, that's Acts chapter 8. Acts chapter 9, our main character for the rest of the book of Acts, Saul's conversion. Acts chapter 10, this is just like Acts chapter 2, it's going to be Gentiles, Spirit, Kingdom, just like Acts 2, but in this case it's with the Gentiles. Last week we were in Acts chapter 11, and Acts chapter 11 is report in Antioch. So everyone say report in Antioch. All right, good. Now we are in Acts chapter 12. And if we remember our outline from chapter 1, verse 8, chapters 1 through 7 are dealing with what primary city in the book of Acts? Jerusalem. That's the main location that is the emphasis of chapters 1 through 7. And then you go on to chapters 8 through 12, and what is the main emphasis, the location geographically of those chapters? Judea and Samaria. And then finally, we're going to wrap up chapter 12 today, and we are going to move on to the last half of the book of Acts, which is going to be all the way to the ends of the earth. So last time we left off, we're in Acts chapter 11, and the church begins in Antioch. And the church in Antioch, what kind of people is the church composed mostly of? Jews or Gentiles? Well, originally, remember, they were only preaching to Jews, but when they got to Antioch, there were those that were from Cyprus and Cyrene, and they brought the word of the Lord to the Gentiles. And so who did they send all the way up to Antioch to go and teach the Gentiles? It was Barnabas. And so Barnabas goes up to Antioch and he needs some more help. So there is this guy who was specifically designed to teach the Gentiles. He's hiding out in Tarsus. Who's that? That was Paul or Saul. And so Barnabas goes and gets Saul. They stay there for a whole year. But then Agabus, the prophet, comes up and he prophesies there's going to be a great famine over the land. And so they send down Paul and Barnabas with a gift to disperse to the elders because of this great famine that's taking place. And the reason we're covering that again is chapter 12 is going to be bookended by Luke, by their journey down to Jerusalem and then their journey back up to Antioch. And then Luke, as a historian, is going to take an aside and he's going to cover some very important things that took place between their journey down to Jerusalem and their journey back up to Antioch. So let's start off in verse 1. And so here we read, "About that time, Herod the king laid violent hands on some who belonged to the church." Now, when we open up the New Testament scriptures, how many different Herods are there actually? I mean, it's kind of like Mary, or James, or John even. There was a lot of them. And so, in this case, this is not talking about the Herod, of course, that was the one who ordered the execution of all the children at the time of Christ. This is actually his grandson, which would be Herod Agrippa I. And he would also be the brother of the woman who asked for the head of John the Baptist. Anyone remember her name? It was Herodias. And so this is her brother. This is Herod Agrippa I. And this, there's a lot you can read historically about him. I don't want to go off on a huge tangent. If you want to learn more about him, you can read Josephus' Antiquities or Reese in his commentary gives a really good overview of his life. But here's what you need to understand. Politicians, in order to have favor with the people and get the people to be in good standings with them, what are politicians willing to do? Okay. It doesn't matter what it takes in general, and I'm not making a case against politicians today that all are like this, but especially in that time, whatever it took to be able to gain the favor of the people is what the king would do. And so in this case, the Jews are all up in arms because of what the Christians are doing, especially at this point, because even for the Christians, what was hard for them to accept that started in Acts chapter 10? Remember, Peter comes back to Jerusalem and he's criticized by the fellow Christians. What was he criticized for?
Gentiles.
Because now the Gentiles have acceptance into the kingdom. Do you think this has flared up the animosity between Jews and Christians? Because if you were a Jew, you haven't come to this understanding that the Gentiles are welcome to the kingdom. So you are absolutely stood opposed to this. And so Herod comes down, he's ruling over this area. And I want us to remember, this is a historical account. We need to look at this with respect and with honor. Here we're going to have the recording of the very first apostle that was martyred for the faith. And it says, and he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. Remember the sons of Zebedee? And this would be the way that Romans did execution. How did the Jews do execution? Yeah, they stoned them to death. The Roman way of civil ruler execution would be by the sword. You would either behead someone or you would run them through. The historical account of James is that James was beheaded. There's even an account that talks about that a soldier was so moved by James' faith that he himself expressed a confession in Christ and was beheaded alongside with James. Don't know if that's true or not. That's just some historical accounts that have been written. But it wouldn't surprise me. And so here James is killed. And notice verse 3. This is just sick when you think about what rulers were willing to do. And when he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. And this was during the days of unleavened bread. So as long as he's in good standing with the Jews, whatever they like is what he's going to do. Same thing, remember, with Pilate. When Pilate questioned Jesus and examined Jesus, what was the conclusion that Pilate came to? He said, he's innocent. I'm going to release Barabbas to you, right? Even like, who do you want? Do you want this murder or do you want Jesus? And they continued to yell, crucify him. And the way the text reads is, he was set on this, but it said their voices prevailed. Because of his fear for the people, because he wanted to do the people's bidding, the people's will, he was willing to send an innocent man to his death and his execution. Now here's a question. Why was James picked out? How much have we read about James' ministry in Jerusalem from Luke in the book of Acts here? We don't know anything. We've only had the focus on Peter, and we've had the focus on John. We haven't heard anything about James. But it's obvious that James was doing an incredible amount of work in evangelism, or else he wouldn't have been singled out by Herod. We just aren't told of the kind of work that he was doing. But obviously, James was this forefigure that would have been right there at the center of this debate between the Jews and the Christians. And so Herod puts him to death, and he arrests Peter. The only reason Peter isn't killed right away is Herod would have understood that this is a time period this was one of the most holy time periods, the holy feast for the Jews, because this was the Passover, the feast of the unleavened bread. And ironically, you go back several years earlier, who was unfairly arrested and sentenced to death at this time period, just a few years earlier? It was Jesus. Yeah, John. That's it. When the Jews are coming in, and this is perfect timing for Herod. How many Jews would flock in for the Passover? I mean, you read the numbers. It was millions of people all gathered together. And so if he wanted to make a spectacle of the Christians to please the Jews, what would be the perfect time to do it? When all the Jews are all gathered into one place. Yeah, Wayne.
Just a small side note, interesting bit of trivia. The Latter-day Saints believe that God had resurrected James and was one of those who had visited Joseph Smith.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting. He's dead. That's very clear in the text. But I didn't know that. That was very interesting. Now, Herod is going to understand this is a holy time, and so he's not going to have Peter killed right away. Verse 4, Herod's going to wait. It says, about that time, Herod the king, or I missed this, sorry, well, let's go to here. Remember when Jesus was talking to James and John, and they approached Jesus in Matthew chapter 10, they said, grant us to sit at your right hand. And what did Jesus promise both to James and to John? He says, that's not mine to give, right? But I can promise you that you're going to drink from the cup that I drink, and you're going to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized. And of course, Jesus was referring to a cup of death and a baptism of suffering. And here, that prophecy of Jesus is fulfilled in the execution of James. Very early on, the very first apostle to die, and very early on in the work. But here, Herod had plans for Peter as well. This was going to be Peter's fate at the end of the Feast of the Unleavened Bread. And we're going to look at that later on in verse 11. We'll see the same thing. It says, and when he seized him, he put him in prison, delivering him over to four squads of soldiers to guard him. Now, a squad had four soldiers in it. So if you had four squads, that's 16 Roman soldiers that are put just in charge of one man. Is Herod taking any precautions with Peter? Why not? Go back to Acts chapter 5. Remember what happened to the apostles? All the apostles are arrested. And they're put in prison by the Sanhedrin. And then what happens that night as they're in prison? An angel comes in and lets them out. And so they go in the next day to bring them out. And where are the apostles? They're gone. They're at the temple. Peter is a very good escape artist from prison already. And so he assigns 16 men to Peter. And we're going to see there's not two men that left his side at any time for any reason. And they intended to bring him out, Herod, that is, after the Passover to the people. And of course, what is he going to do when he brings Peter out to the people?
Execute.
Yeah. What would you like me to do with this one you call Peter? And with James, what was their answer? Execute him. And in this case, it would have been the exact same thing that took place for Peter. And so Peter was kept in prison, but I want us to notice this. But earnest prayer was made to God by the church. We're going to see how earnest this was, because when Peter is going to escape again, and because that's just how it works, you can't mess with God's plans, the church is going to be gathered praying, and it's well past midnight. And I just want to ask, at what time has there been something so serious going on within our country or within one of the brethren here that the church gathered together and were just gathered together in prayer well into the wee hours of the night? You know, this is an example for the way that we ought to pray. I remember when we would go to visit Grammy and Pop-Pop out in California, the men at Escalon had a prayer meeting on a regular basis, and they would get together and just pray about people that were spiritually weak or just the growth of the church or those that were physically sick, and it would be 2 hours of prayer. And that was one of the most wonderful experiences for me to go to. And this is just, I just wanted to bring this out. This is, we participate in prayer in our worship, and we generally have a typical way in which we do prayer. You know, we'll have three or four prayers throughout the service, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. I just want to convey to you, I was talking to Keith Stonehart about this, and we were talking about this principle, and he wanted to share with me something that impressed him. They were doing Wednesday night Bible study, And Steve Wilshire, one of the elders there, came in and knocked on the door and said, hey, we need everyone to come into the auditorium. And so everyone came in. They didn't know what was going on. It was mid-class. And Steve just got up there and said, we have some serious things going on in this group, and we need to pray about it. And then they all just bowed, and for the next 45 minutes, they just stopped and all prayed together about the things that were going on. If we believe in the power of prayer, this is the kind of efforts that we will make in petition to our Lord. Not just praying before a meal, not just praying before bed, not just praying when we are all gathered together at the beginning of a service or at the end of a service. And those are good things to do. I'm not saying we should not do those. But we need to really examine our prayer life and go to the Father when there's a need, so we can just pour out our hearts to Him and talk to Him, just as the church did here. I wonder what's going through Peter's mind at this point, because remember, James and John were not the only ones that were prophesied about their death. Remember the very end of John chapter 21? When Jesus asked Peter three times, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? Yes, Lord, you know I love you. And then Jesus prophesied Peter's death as well. And he said, truly I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you're old, you will stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. And this he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. And after saying this, he said to him, follow me. Now, I cannot imagine what's going through Peter's mind here. It's the night before he's supposed to be executed. James has already been executed. Maybe these words are going through his mind. Am I old already? I don't feel old. Is this what the Lord wants from me? Is this how I'm going to honor him? Is by dying now? Is he going to deliver me? We don't know what's going through Peter's mind. But I guarantee you this might have crossed his mind at some point, because these were the words of Jesus to him, one of the last words. And so we go on. This is one of my favorite accounts in the book of Acts, just because of the nature and the way with which God works. And so beginning in verse 6, now when Herod was about to bring him out on that very night, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and sentries before the door were guarding the prison. So here's the picture. This is how we know it was past midnight. The watches of the night, which are recorded in Mark, happened at either increments of 6 or 12 hours. It appears that they happened at 6, and so they would rotate soldiers every 6 hours. So if it was midnight, they had rotated. Here we find Peter sleeping. We're going to come on later when daylight comes and it illuminates the cell. Guess who's not going to be there at that point? And that's going to be about 6 o'clock in the morning. So these things all happen in the middle of the night. And Peter, is Peter going anywhere when you see this? I mean, he is strapped to two soldiers. There is no possible way that Peter is going to get anywhere. And then there are two more soldiers in front of the door. It appears at different stages within the door. There would have been perhaps a tunnel leading up to it. And so Peter is on absolute lockdown. And yet, verse 7, and behold, an angel of the Lord stood next to him, and a light shone in the cell, and he struck Peter on the side and woke him, saying, get up quickly. That's an abrupt way to wake someone up, by the way. Peter's there, he's sleeping, which, that's interesting. Just think about that for a moment. If you knew that you were going to be dying in the next 6 hours, how many of you would be sleeping well? This reminds me, go back in your minds to Jesus when he was in the boat, and there was a huge storm going on around him. And what was Jesus doing?
Sleeping.
The other apostles, they talk about a backhanded comment. Do you not care that we're dying? And they strike Jesus and wake him up. Why was Jesus so peaceful? Why was he able to sleep? I mean, he is the master over the winds and the waves. He had no reason to fear. When you consider the place that Peter's at, Peter knows the master. It serves the master of the one who overcame death. He's the one who rose from the dead. And Peter knows that no matter what happens, he doesn't have anything to fear. If he dies, he's in the hands of his Savior. If he lives, he is blessed by his Savior to continue his work as an apostle. That's just amazing that Peter's sleeping to begin with. But this angel literally kicks him awake and says, get up. And so he starts to, and this is interesting, it says the chains fell off his hands. How'd that happen? Doesn't say, and guys, we're talking about Rome here. These would not be old rusted chains that some fisherman, because he was strong, you'd be amazed what you can read, would have been able to rip off without waking or disturbing the other guards. We don't know what the other guards are doing at this point. We don't know if they're sleeping. We don't know if they're stunned. That was the case of the guards when the angel appeared at the tomb of Jesus. The guards were just stunned. It was as though they were paralyzed, as dead men. They couldn't move. The text is going to seem to imply that somehow their eyes and their ears are completely hidden from what's actually taking place. Because when daylight comes, they're absolutely in shock as to where's Peter. They still think that he's chained to them this entire time. And so the chains fall off his hand. The angel says to him, dress yourself, put on your sandals. He did so. And he said to him, wrap your cloak around you and follow me. And he went out and followed him, and he did not know what was being done by the angel was real, but he thought he was seeing a vision. Why would Peter think he's seeing a vision?
Because he's seen one before.
Okay, one, Peter's very familiar with visions from the Lord. He's seen them often. Remember the great white sheet that was lowered down? Yeah, Aaron.
The lack of the reaction from the guards.
That is a huge one for me. In dreams or in visions, sometimes things happen that don't make sense, and if it's a lucid dream, You recognize that. You're like, oh, that doesn't make sense, but cool. You just keep, doing whatever it was that you're dreaming. Imagine Peter here, and these would have made noise, and there's light everywhere, and chains fall, and he's sitting here getting dressed, and the guards are just, and Peter's like, oh, okay. So it walks up, door opens, two guards standing right there, looking right at the door. Peter stops. What happens? Well, and he went out and followed him. And when they had passed the first and the second guard, just walks right past him. No reaction whatsoever. And they came to the iron gate leading into the city, and it opened for them on its own accord, and they went out and went along one street, and immediately the angel left him. Couple things about that. This tells us that when Peter was imprisoned, that he was imprisoned outside of the city. And there are a lot of scholars that agree that it's likely that Peter would have been held in the Tower of Antonia. And in the Codex Bizet, it talks about, it has some added text here that a priest would have added later or a scribe would have added later. And it says that Peter went down 7 steps. And that's one of the main features of that tower outside of the city. So it's likely that that's where he was. We don't know for sure. But here's what's interesting. The gates would have been closed for security for the rest of the night, absolutely on lockdown. And I just think this is humorous. The Greek word here is automatos, which is where we get our word automatic. And so we think nothing of it. We go to a grocery store. You walk up to the door. What does the door do? Can you imagine Peter's reaction? Peter was the first one to witness an automatic door. we think we're so good with our technology. The Lord had us beat by 2,000 years on this one, okay? And so Peter walks up to this gate, and there would have been, of course, guards stationed at the front gate of the city as well, and the gate just opens up, and Peter walks in, and the gate closes, and they're just standing there. And they go down one street, and then Peter turns, and the angel's gone. And so here's Peter. He can probably feel the cold of night at this point. He's waking up at this point. And he's just standing in the middle of the city. He's looking around. And so Peter finally comes to his senses. Have you ever done that where you're trying to wake up and things just aren't quite clicking and then finally you're like, oh, okay. It says, when Peter came to himself, he says, now I am sure that the Lord has sent his angels and rescued me from the hand of Herod and all that the Jewish people were expecting. That gives us our clue there. What were the Jewish people and Herod expecting? That he was going to die. And here it is, 6 hours before Herod would have gone down to pull him out and present him before the people, and Peter's standing in the middle of the city while everyone else is asleep. And when he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose other name was Mark, where many gathered together and were praying. All right, here we have another Mary, Not Mary, the mother of Jesus, not Mary Magdalene, not Mary and Martha, right? But this is Mary, the mother of John, who is called Mark. Now, who is Mark, John Mark? We're going to learn about him for the rest of the book of Acts.
He's the one that left Paul.
He's going to be the one that left Paul, and then Barnabas and Paul had a huge disagreement about him. But this is what's interesting. Barnabas goes to the defense of John Mark. I never knew this. Colossians chapter 4 tells us that John Mark and Barnabas were first cousins. And so this would have been the aunt of Barnabas that we're reading about here. And she apparently is a believer, and the Christians apparently meet in her home. And this would have been Barnabas' cousin, John Mark, that's going to go with them later back up to Antioch. We don't know how old John Mark is, but John Mark would be the one that would later write the Gospel of Mark that we have. And so, very key, important character that we need to recognize here as well. And so we move on. This is where Peter wants to do. Peter needs to go. He needs to inform the disciples what's happened to him. And then what does Peter need to do? He's got to get out of town because daylight's going to come. They're going to recognize he's gone and they're going to start searching for him. And so Peter needs to get in and get out really quick. Here's the problem. Peter is going to have an easier time escaping from a maximum security prison than entering the home of a friend. And so Peter goes to the door, and he begins to knock at the door of the gateway, and a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. That's really interesting. This is just some random servant girl, and yet Luke calls her by name. There are so many other, you would argue, more important people that aren't named in the book of Acts, and yet here we have a name for this servant girl. Why would Luke have named her? Any thoughts? Any questions? Or yeah, Josiah. I think so. And if she was a servant girl in this house, this appears to have been a place where the church met on a regular basis, is this house. And here she would have known Barnabas, she would have known Paul, she would have known John Mark, all of these different things. And here's another interesting note. Remember, there were two people at the beginning of this chapter that were coming down to Jerusalem. And who were they? Barnabas and Saul. If this is Barnabas' aunt, you think Barnabas might have stopped by to say hello? We're going to see that later on at the very end of this chapter, they're leaving Jerusalem and they're taking John Mark with them. Obviously, they came here at some point. It's not in the text, but there's a possibility that Barnabas and Paul were among this group that was praying for Peter in the house that night. We aren't sure, we aren't certain of the timing, but that's a possibility to consider. And so Rhoda comes to the door. She would have known Peter because it says she recognized Peter's voice, and in her joy, she didn't open the gate but ran in and reported that Peter was standing at the gate. So she goes to her job is to answer the door. She goes to answer the door. She hears it's Peter. She goes running back in to tell everybody else. Meanwhile, where's Peter? Hello? Like, there's probably people looking for me. I need to get in. And so she runs in, and yet this is really interesting because what was the whole church gathered together to do? What was their whole purpose? They're praying, and apparently for Peter. And yet she runs in, and she tells them that Peter's at the door, and this is their first reaction. They said to her, "You're out of your mind." Well, wait a second. If you're praying for Peter and for God's hand upon Peter, and all of a sudden your servant reports that he's at the door, your first reaction is, you're crazy? Your first reaction is, you're out of your mind? Why would they respond this way? Yeah.
Well, they understand that Peter was kept in prison in the fact of what happened to James. And, you know, the fact is that he was basically in maximum custody. I mean, there's no way. You got to be out of your mind. Mm-hmm. The extent in which Herod went to deal with Peter, there's no way. James couldn't escape it, so how is Peter now going to escape that?
I think that's going to be part of it, because James delivered from the Lord? No, it was the Lord's will that James was put to death. If God wanted to deliver James, could James have also escaped from the hand of Herod?
Yes.
Absolutely. And yet, they understand that it was the Lord's will for James to die. We know that they're praying for Peter. We aren't really told what they're praying for, though. Maybe they aren't expecting Peter to get out. Maybe they're expecting a quick death, or maybe they're praying that they change their mind upon the next day. We don't know what they were praying for, but obviously what wasn't on their mind is that God was going to divinely allow Peter to put on an invisibility cloak and walk out of the prison, so to speak, you know. And so this is just really interesting, but I think it teaches us something about prayer too. A lot of times we pray to God for certain things, but we kind of keep God in a box. Like, these are the ways that God can answer my prayer. And we limit God mentally as to the ways in which he can answer us. And the fact is God, and he's going to do as he pleases. And many times, I will be praying for something, and there'll be something that is done or an answer to that that I would have never expected, that I had never thought about. And so, here they're telling her, you're out of your mind. And she keeps insisting, no, he's at the door. And maybe they're thinking she's tired, it's late, you're emotional, you've been crying. So they say, well, it's probably just his angel. Common Jewish mysticism was that everyone had a guardian angel around them. Here, my thought is, well, if Peter's guardian angel's at the door, you better open the door. But they're just in disbelief that it's actually Peter. But Peter continued knocking, and they opened, and they saw him, and were amazed. But motioning to them with his hand to be silent, he described to them how the Lord had brought him out of prison, and he said, tell these things to James and to the brothers, and he departed and went to another place. So, yeah.
The book of James, BJ, talks about when we pray, let a man ask in faith, mm-hmm. Doubting nothing.
Yeah, don't doubt anything.
And I guess the lesson for us is don't underestimate the power of God, and don't doubt. Jesus talked a lot about your faith. If it, to a certain degree, you could move mountains. And James in chapter 1 says, you know, when you ask of God, don't doubt it. And I think sometimes it's similar to what you were saying. We put God in a box and yeah. Pray and not really expecting anything to happen.
Yeah, yeah. John?
I was thinking along the same line. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen.
Yeah.
These guys were put right in the middle of that, and they were tasting and realizing something that wasn't a possibility.
That's right.
I was going through my mind, too, that when the doors open automatically, people that read the Bible for the first time, they'd probably be okay up until that point in time. Even Christians, believers, get to that point, and some Christians even say, well, that really didn't happen. That's part of the mythology, maybe. That's just part of the story.
Yeah.
And the angels come down.
Yeah, we have to explain everything from a naturalistic perspective.
But it's definitely alluded to the fact that there's some things are at play that in these people's lives and maybe in ours that's out of our control and it's supernatural, that it's something that Christians that they don't even want to approach. You know?
Good.
I have a hard time dealing with it.
Mm-hmm. Dwayne.
Mm-hmm. Well, not too long ago, we just had two fellows that escaped from maximum security, took off for a number of weeks, were finally caught or killed. I don't like to think of the jobs of the people around that. They're gone.
Mm-hmm.
Heavy punishment, but probably, well, forget the word probably, definitely not as difficult as it was back in the Roman times when Herod, Agrippa, had these soldiers who had this prisoner under their control, lost them, if you will, Mm-hmm. It was death.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think any of those soldiers would have helped him escape knowing what judgment would have been coming to him as soldiers.
That's right.
So the only other thing to accept... I think there were 16 men there that truly believed somehow he miraculously escaped because they didn't let it happen because they didn't want to die.
That's right. But he would not accept that, just like his grandfather would not accept. You know, everything always has pointed to Christ and the miraculous and to recognize God. And at this point, Herod should have recognized God has his hand in this, like those soldiers probably did, and I need to back off. But Herod's not going to do that. Hewlin.
I was just going to say something similar to what Tim said. Mm-hmm. He walked away from four guards that were assigned directly to him, actually chained to two of them.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, and I know that those outside could not have been sleeping. I don't know what the Roman regulations were for with a prisoner inside, because normally if you slept on the job, that would also be execution. So I don't know about the ones inside. Yeah.
If it was mythical, then the mentioning of the servant girl would be unnecessary.
Yeah, good point.
During the time of antiquity, when the woman would have used it at all, their testimony would be weak.
Especially a young girl. You have a young slave girl or servant girl, that's the last person you would talk to testify about. But that's a really good point. Yeah, John, and then Ann.
That's encouraging, the comments I'm hearing. So we have no problem with faith then, that we allow faith to be the conviction of our souls, and when God speaks on any other terms and in regards to anything else, then we will do what he says.
That's right.
Without question.
That's right.
We will not fear, we will accept it even though we don't understand it.
Amen. And that's the hardest thing about faith. That's right. Ann.
That's interesting because I kind of love, okay, God is intervening in my life. I'd probably be the same way. Mm-hmm. I don't realize at the time that what's being done by a divine being on me, my life, right now, in this time, is real. And might think of a vision like he thought. Then you go down and it says that in verse 11, then when Peter came to himself, it's interesting because that's the next step. Mm-hmm. In a human being, the divine happening to you. Mm-hmm. You come to yourself, and then it says in verse 12, when he realized. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I think that's what happens with human beings, the way their mind works. And then, even the people couldn't even grab it, mm-hmm. couldn't even comprehend the divine action here with happening on them as human beings. Mm-hmm. They were amazed. They came to the realization. And that is what I think that human experience is with the divine. It leads you down this path of it is real, God is real, he does amazing.
That's right. That's right. Aaron.
Mm-hmm. Say that we just give it mythical qualities. But mm-hmm. the thing I find so interesting is like Saul and the witch, and even in the next chapter, 13 of Acts, where it talks about the sorcerer. You know, God is against letting people believe in that kind of stuff. You know, he doesn't want people going to witches, to sorcerers, and everything like that. But then people turn around and say that believers in the Bible are believing in a fairy tale, that there are always explanations for it. And it's funny because, you know, to me that makes it more real. You know, I mean, obviously if God didn't want us believing in sorcerers and witches, you know, then what he's displaying is the real alternative to it. And there's no scientific explanation for this divine intervention.
The real source, the real power. Right. I laugh. I read something this week. I just share it with you briefly, and then we got to move on. It was about a scientific explanation for the crossing of the Red Sea. And they said, well, it would have been, an area that definitely would have had to have been, you know, you know, some kind of activity, but a great wind would have blown it aside in a marshy area. And the response back was, that's right. And then 4 inches of water drowned the entire Egyptian army. And I just like, really? So, but I just thought that was interesting. One more comment. Yeah.
200 years ago, people said that it was impossible to take a cell from one person's body and make another person's body. And so we would write off the Genesis of God making Eve from the rib of Adam.
Yeah. It's really interesting. You're right. You know, it's just you can't limit God to what he can and can't do. And so here he tells them, and James here, he says, tell these things to James and to brothers. We have two options here. This could have been James, the son of Alphaeus, one of the 12 apostles, or this could have been James, not the one who was executed, of course, but James, the brother of Jesus. It appears in the context, my understanding is the James mentioned in Acts 15 is that this is the brother of Jesus. Paul in Galatians says that he spoke to no one except for Peter and James, the brother of the Lord, in Galatians chapter 1. And so we know that he was in Jerusalem. And just the way that he says James and the brothers, the way that it signaled out, it seems that that might be who that's referring to as the brother of the Lord. I might be incorrect, but that's my understanding. Peter goes away. We don't know where he is, but we know that 7 years later, yes, 7 years is the time period between this and Acts 15. You don't read that in the text, but Peter's going to be back in Jerusalem for the conference. But we don't know where he went. There's some other things you can read about that. Verse 18 and 19, we're going to hurry along here because we're almost out of time. Now the day came, there was no little disturbance among the soldiers over what became of Peter. We already talked Daylight comes in. I want you to imagine these two soldiers standing there, and they know their job. They are not going to let Peter go because, as Wayne had brought out, there's no way that they would have conspired to let him out because their lives would be required for it. And so they're doing their job. They're not believers. Daylight breaks, comes into the cell. They look, and they're looking right at each other. Peter is completely gone. They go running outside. Where's Peter? What do you mean, where's Peter? He was chained to you guys. He's not here. Herod comes, he starts cross-examining them, could come to two conclusions. Either the hand of God was here, he's going to honor the Lord, or he's going to ignore that fact and just do as he pleases. Guess what Herod does, as usual? He ignores that fact and he just puts them all to death. It doesn't say whether that was the 16 or the 4. The language seems to mean that it's the 16. He examined the centuries. And so even the ones that weren't there, it appears Herod just killed everybody. And said, all right, you failed your job. A search is done for Peter. We aren't told how long that search lasted for. But then, if you're Herod, you've promised the Jews, hey, I've got Peter arrested. I'm going to present him to you, and then you can decide what you want to do. Next day comes along. Are you going to show up and tell every Jew that's there, hey, I don't know where Peter went? No, you're going to do what too? You're going to get out of town. So Herod goes to Caesarea, leaves Judea, goes to Caesarea. When he gets there, we got to run real quick through this. Apparently, he was really angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon for some reason. And this is really interesting because this was not his region, and to wage war against them would have caused a huge uproar with Rome. So apparently, he must have been extraordinarily angry at these cities for some reason. But they apparently bribe his chamberlain and win an audience with the king, and they're begging for peace because they depend on Galilee for food, and he's the ruler of Galilee, so if he's angry with them, even if he doesn't go to war with them, they'll all starve to death because they don't have the food that they need. So they're begging for an audience for the king, they're begging for peace, and here, apparently this was, as recorded, it would have been on the second day of the games and sports in Caesarea to honor the Caesar at that time, Claudius. And Herod puts on his royal robes, which other secular accounts say were this flowing silver tissue. We don't know, but it would have been this apparel that would have made him, when he step out in the light, just glisten and shine and appear just grandiose in front of everyone. And so he took his seat upon the throne and delivered an oration to them. And apparently it was, I'm going to give you peace because of their response. Their response, the voice of a God, not of a man. And immediately an angel of the Lord struck him down because he did not give God the glory, and he was eaten by worms and breathed his last. It is just amazing. When you consider this, when Cornelius fell down at the feet of Peter. Peter pulled him up and said, "Stand up, I too am just a man." Later on, we're going to see at Lystra, and not just a few chapters later, Paul and Barnabas are at Lystra, and they start worshiping them as Zeus and Hermes, and they tear their clothes and say, "What are you doing? You need to serve the living God." And they rebuke them for what they were doing. That's the proper response. And yet, here Herod, this is apparently what he was wanting. "Look at how great and powerful I am. Yes, I am a God. I look great. I'm in front of all you. I have the power to take. I have the power to give. I'm going to give. Look how great I am." And then God shows him how great he was. Secular accounts record that he collapsed during his oration and 5 days later died. These would have been earthworm-sized tapeworms inside his stomach, is the Greek word that's used there for worms. Just nasty stuff. Again, the hand of the Lord directly upon the life of an individual. And then we're done, but the word of the Lord increased and multiplied. That's one of Luke's segue things, is when you see the word of the Lord multiplied, that means that we're moving on to a different section. And then Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem, and they had completed their service, bringing with them John, whose other name is Mark. That's the bookend. Chapter 12 is done. The focus from now on is going to be at Antioch, and next week we start Paul's first missionary journey that starts with Barnabas and him and in Antioch. So, awesome.